From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Now that the Republicans have won control of the House and the Senate, what's ahead for the Clinton presidency? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Elizabeth Drew. She's been covering Washington politics since the 1960s. Her new book is a behind-the-scenes investigation of the Clinton White House called On the Edge. Also, a new film noir that is both vicious and witty. It's called The Last Seduction, and it's directed by John Dahl, who also made Red Rock West. We'll meet the star of The Last Seduction, Linda Fiorentino. She's been described as one of the screen's most formidable femme fatales ever. And we'll meet the screenwriter, Steve Baranczyk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says he takes partial blame for the results from yesterday's election. Mr. Clinton says voters are holding Democrats responsible for not fulfilling their outlined goals. The president says he'll work with a new Republican majority.
I will do everything in my power to reach out to the leaders and the members of this new Congress. It must be possible to make it a more effective, more functioning institution. It must be possible for us to give our people a government that is smaller, that is more effective, that reflects both our interests and our values.
The GOP has wrested control of both chambers of Congress away from the Democrats. Republicans haven't run the House of Representatives since the Eisenhower administration. Senate Republican leader Robert Dole has been asked if he's worried whether there's danger that a Republican-controlled Congress will allow both chambers to work smoothly and make President Clinton look like a more effective leader.
If, in fact, we work out some of the legislative problems and agree on it, I'm not certain. I think everybody gets credit for it. With a Republican Congress, I'd assume we'd get some credit. But if we agree on it, I guess we can't worry about whether it helps the president or helps the Congress. I indicated the president this morning, probably some things we couldn't agree on.
Republican Senator Phil Graham of Texas is promising sweeping changes after yesterday's Republican victory. He says voters have endorsed the conservative agenda of limited government and lower taxes. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
Senator Graham has a long list for a Republican-controlled Congress. Rewrite the crime bill and strip it of prevention programs, cut farming subsidies, cut welfare and Medicaid. Graham proposes across-the-board reductions in the federal agencies concerned with health, housing, and education. The cuts would pay for a doubling of the dependent child tax deduction. Graham anticipates the Democratic response.
They're going to say, well, you're cutting spending for housing and nutrition and education. No, I'm not. I'm trying to change who is doing the spending. They want the government to do the spending. I want the family to do the spending.
Graham says he's ready to work with President Clinton, but he warns cooperation will never get off the ground if the president doesn't change his policies. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama has changed parties. The former Democrat has joined the ranks of the newly empowered Republican majority. And Speaker of the House Tom Foley has conceded defeat. Foley says it appears when all absentee votes are counted in his Washington state district, he'll fall a few votes short of his Republican challenger. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 2.5 points at 3,828. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The two-day Franco-African summit in France ended today with an agreement to create an African peacekeeping force. But some analysts are skeptical. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French President François Mitterrand said the 35 African countries who attended the summit, including South Africa, agreed on the need for a peacekeeping force on the continent. Mitterrand said France would provide logistical support. He said the organization and details of the project would have to be worked out. France proposed the idea partly because it doesn't want to launch another peacekeeping mission in Africa alone. But military officials say the fact that France didn't have much African support shows it would be difficult to get the Africans to back the project with troops. They also fear some African dictators would try to use the force to maintain their grip on power. Still, France is determined to press ahead and will seek backing for the project from the European Union. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Renewed fighting in Bosnia is proving successful for the Bosnian Serbs. The United Nations says Serbs have recaptured some territory in Bihać in northwestern Bosnia. The enclave had been the scene of some recent advances by the Muslim-led Bosnian army. The news of the Serbian gain comes as the Bosnian Serb Assembly gathers to discuss the new fighting. The Assembly is also expected to formally declare war on the Bosnian government. The head of the UN peacekeeping force has asked military leaders from both sides to meet him at Sarajevo Airport to talk. Federal regulators are ordering refunds for overcharged cable subscribers. The Federal Communications Commission says customers of two cable systems in Maryland and Tennessee will share about $500,000 in refunds. The paybacks cover the periods from September of last year through this past May. The FCC says the charges were excessively non-competitive. The order is the first since Congress voted 2 years ago to start regulating cable rates. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Republicans will now control the House and the Senate for the first time in 40 years. And that means President Clinton's legislative agenda will face tough opposition. At his press conference this afternoon, the president said that he would do everything in his power to reach out to the leaders and members of this new Congress. My guest, Elizabeth Drew, has spent the past few years investigating what's happened behind the scenes at the Clinton White House. Drew is the author of the new book, On the Edge, The Clinton Presidency. She's been writing about Washington politics since the 1960s. She wrote for The New Yorker for about 20 years and frequently appears on Meet the Press. I asked her if she thinks the Clinton administration has new priorities and strategies in place to face the new Congress.
I don't know that the plan would be any different than what it was going to be before they knew the exact outcome. Because you see, Terry, there was no way that Clinton was going to come out of this election with a working majority in either the House or the Senate. He barely had it in his first 2 years. You remember in the book all these very, very close shaves and hard-fought battles to win his legislative victories. And they already knew that it was going to be a lot harder after the elections. And in some ways, some of the people around him thought that it wasn't an altogether bad thing for him to lose the Senate, because then he would have something to point to as a reason he wasn't getting anything more done, as opposed to having a Democratic Congress, ostensibly Democratic Congress, but not getting more done. So I don't think the plan necessarily changes. It's to come up with a far more modified health care proposal. It's to pursue welfare reform. It's to do a little bit more on deficit reduction growing out of the of a Kerry commission that was set up. And it was already thought that he wasn't going to do that much legislatively. You know, there was a lot of criticism, and I must say I thought it too, in the early months of the Clinton administration, that he was taking on too much. He had his reasons, and he was right. The major power of a president is in his first, I would say, 18 months. This is the period that I covered. And the power always dissipates after that. You're into the presidential election after the first two sessions of Congress. So they were right to try to get a lot done during that period, and they did get a lot done. Oddly, the public doesn't understand that, which we could come back to. The other thing that they're planning to do in this next period, they keep saying they're going to do it, but I think they're more serious now, is have Clinton make more use of the bully pulpit. He's very good, almost at his best, when he talks about the urban problems and the problem of children killing children. And he could really lead a national effort in this respect, and I think they're going to try. And the other thing that they have talked about doing is spending more time demonstrating the implementation of the programs that have been passed, partly because people don't know they've been passed, and partly because they don't have any sense of the impact on their communities and their lives. So I think the emphasis is going to be in those directions, not always on legislation.
Well, you write in your new book that President Clinton knew early on that losing control of the Congress was a real possibility, so he tried to get as much legislation passed early on as possible. How effective do you think he was at that?
He was very effective. He got a great deal done. Some things that people do know about, obviously the deficit reduction, the getting the NAFTA treaty with Mexico passed, and he was able to shift some of the spending priorities toward the domestic programs that he called investments. It was actually more spending for such things as Head Start, education, and so on. Now, I think the Republican Congress will probably put a stop to that.
I know that you share the widely held view that yesterday's election was really a referendum on Clinton, and the voting in of Republicans is a rejection of Clinton. You think Clinton was reasonably effective in getting legislation passed. What do you think hurt him most?
I think it's a combination of things, as I lay out in the book, and that is he and Mrs. Clinton were astonishingly unprepared to govern. When I say astonishingly, it's because they both are very, very smart people. They both had been in and out of Washington a lot in the course of their adult lives, working on national issues. They both had access to networks of people who would have helped them. But they really felt that they could do this on their own. They had a surprising antipathy to Washington, which many people may find understandable, but it's a little surprising in them since they really had so many bases here. Anyway, they felt that they could handle this. They deliberately, in choosing the White House staff, did not go for experience. They went for people who didn't have any independent standing and weren't Washington figures. Later on, the president's close aide, Bruce Lindsay, said, well, we went too far. But their idea was, we want to change things, and anybody who's in Washington ipso facto is against change, which was a silly overgeneralization. So having picked this inexperienced staff and doing it only 6 days before the inauguration, they started making mistakes right away. He had to drop his attorney general nominee on day one of his presidency. By day three or four, he was in an open fight with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Sam Nunn on the policy of not allowing gays to serve in the military. This said to people, this man who had run and tried to define himself as a centrist was over on the left. I know people still bring that up about gays in the military. The other things are, though he did accomplish things, he just didn't get it across. I lay some percentage of that to, a high percentage of that to Clinton and his aides. Another probably equal proportion to the press, which is not interested in those stories as much as they are in conflict and problems. And there were just a number of, because of the inexperience, there were a number of pratfalls, such as the haircut on the runway in Los Angeles, such as the handling of the travel office, even something seemingly minor as the in the great scheme of things, as a White House aide taking a couple of helicopters to play golf. All of these things eroded Clinton's political strength, eroded confidence in him, and got in the way of and distracted the White House people from their jobs and distracted the public from what he was getting done.
During Clinton's campaign, the, quote, character problem was something that was perceived as working against him. Do you think that followed him into his presidency?
I definitely think it followed him into his presidency, and it intensified. People elected him in 92 with a not very large plurality, 43%, with some misgivings about his character. This embraced several things. One is his personal past and the Jennifer Flowers episode, and one was Whitewater was kind of there, but it didn't. A lot of attention wasn't paid to it, and some of it was what's known as the Slick Willie phenomenon. The I didn't inhale, being a little too cute by half. So he was elected with misgivings, and then what happens is you get into the White House, and the focus is so much more intense. I mean, nobody is really prepared for that. And the remarks are so much more scrutinized, and you hear so much more from him. So that all those things became intensified. And though his aides, when various scandals broke, like the Arkansas troopers alleging that Clinton had, as governor, had used them to arrange alleged multiple assignations, more Whitewater, his aides say, oh, all that was covered in the campaign. The American people have made up their minds on that. It's a closed subject, but it's not. And every reminder of that, as these same aides perfectly know, erodes Clinton's authority and effectiveness. And they really live in fear of more shoes dropping. And connected with that was an erosion of the moral authority of the Oval Office. I think that's Clinton's most serious problem. He wanted to be one of the people, which is fine, but just up to a point. The American people also want dignity and majesty in that Oval Office. And Clinton, in a way, was too much with us. He talked too much. He was too accessible. His aides tried desperately to get him to wear tracksuits when he jogged, because those shorts aren't marvelous to behold, to not make policy pronouncements when he's just finished jogging all sweaty and in that baseball cap. Having allowed that aura of the Oval Office to slip away, I think Clinton has been far more vulnerable, because he doesn't get the presumptions that people usually attribute to a president. And I don't know if he can get it back. I think that's the hardest thing he has to do.
Journalist Elizabeth Drew is my guest. She's the author of a new book about the Clinton presidency called On the Edge. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the election and the Clinton presidency with journalist Elizabeth Drew. President Clinton will now be working with a Republican-controlled Congress. You write about some interesting problems he had early on in getting votes. You say that he didn't really know how to ask for a vote.
Well, that's true. There was a lot of on-the-job learning here. And early on, he would make phone calls and say, well, I, you know, certainly hope you'll be with us. But he didn't really ask for a vote, and he didn't really nail anything down. But Clinton is a learner and a grower.
So do you think he learned how to do it?
He definitely learned how to do it. Now,
is he good at it now?
He's good at it, but there arose another problem. A member of Congress, a Democratic House member of some real importance, said to me, you know, he's too accessible to us. In other words, he was so accessible, and it became so easy, really, to get something from him in exchange for a vote, that it became the normal thing to hold out the vote until he gave something away in exchange for it. This led to a picture of a president who could be rolled, of inconsistency on certain issues. So he paid a price for his accessibility to and his willingness to trade.
No, he passed the crime bill with the help of moderates from both parties. Will there be fewer moderates left in the Democrats and the Republicans in the House and Senate?
Well, there will, and I think this is one of the most important results of the elections, that the Republican caucus in both the House and the Senate will be more to the right. And the Democratic caucuses in the House and the Senate will be more to the left. I think this is going to be a very polarized situation, despite all the talk today about how cooperative everybody's going to be. They're not. I mean, once in a while they will if they see that it's in their interest to try to work together. But I'm actually quite concerned about what I see as an intensively polarized situation. And my real doubt that in that kind of situation and leading into a presidential election, very much will get accomplished. And if what the people are saying is, we want change out of Washington, we want things to be different, and they weren't, so we're going to, you know, upset the tables here and elect Republicans, and they still don't get things, they still don't feel that things have been done, I sort of fear for what the public mood will be after that.
What do you see now as being at the top of President Clinton's agenda and at the top of the Republican congressional agenda?
Well, Clinton will go for the welfare reform bill because that's always been identified as a centrist Democratic issue. And his aides have always found that when he talks about it, people like that. You know, when he gives speeches, they have people pressing buttons to give their response to each little thing. And every time he talked about welfare reform, he got a positive response. So he talked about welfare reform in a lot of speeches, even though they didn't have a plan. They finally came up with a plan, and I think it's going to be more of a battle than it might have been, because the Republicans will undoubtedly want more of a more punitive plan than Clinton will. But that would certainly be one of them, and it gives him a chance to try to get back to the center. There will be other things, as I mentioned, they will come back for a modified health care plan. The Republicans, I think, are in for a much more difficult time than people are suggesting right now. There are going to be divisions among them, and Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich really don't see eye to eye on substance, and they are temperamentally different. And so their position is not going to be an easy one, and they will be constantly sort of examining whether they should be out-and-out opponents or they're seen as too negative and they should try to cooperate. There will be differences in approach between Dole and Gingrich. There will be differences among the other Republicans. So they're not in for a picnic either, and in some ways it's, you know, the worst thing for Clinton would have been to have non-working but apparent majorities in each chamber.
What are the major differences politically and stylistically between Dole and Gingrich?
Well, basically, Dole has been more of a Midwestern, slightly conservative, moderate governing Republican. Gingrich is much more of a bomb thrower. He's much more ideological. He's much more likely to pop off with things that might be of an embarrassment. For instance, last weekend, blaming this Susan Smith tragedy of the two killed children on the Democrats. I think there are going to be a lot of times when Gingrich, who is extremely smart and extremely interesting, I mean, this is going to be great fun to watch, but that he will embarrass the Republicans from time to time.
Now, what are the differences between Dole and Gingrich's political priorities now?
I don't think Dole subscribes to the Contract for America that Gingrich put out, in that Dole is a much more cautious on fiscal issues. He's more of a traditional Republican. He feels that the numbers have to add up. He's more responsible on those issues, and so will be his the budget chairman, Mr. Pete Domenici, than the Republicans in the House will be. In the end, though, there are rules about these things. You can't just go out there and pass things that don't add up. But I think there will be a constant struggle between the House and Senate Republicans, as well as within the parties.
The Contract for America that you referred to, that Gingrich drew up, calls for tax cuts, a balanced budget amendment, term limits.
Yes, and it doesn't add up, and Dole knows that. And the question is how they can, you know, how far they can go in even trying to do this.
Now, how does President Clinton get along with Dole and Gingrich?
Not very well. I think it's been a testy relationship all along. And, you know, when you have Newt Gingrich telling some lobbyists before the election that he really wants a Republican takeover in the House so that they can have a full committee that investigates corruption in the administration, this doesn't make Clinton feel very warm and cozy toward Gingrich. On Dole, it's been testy. They've sometimes been able to work together, but basically not, because Dole really hasn't been a free man all this time. His own Senate caucus, the Republicans are more conservative, of a more conservative and bomb thrower bent than he is. So it's going to be dicey.
As Democrats have been pointing out, the Republicans, now that they're in the majority in Congress, will have more of the responsibility to govern. Do you think that that's going to change anything about the behavior of Republicans within Congress?
I think it is going to cause more difficulty for them, because now they do have to be accountable. And I think that they're going to be wandering around a little bit, deciding how much they really have to be governing Republicans versus opposition to the administration Republicans.
The last sentence of your new book about the Clinton presidency reads, "The president has to redefine what his presidency is about." That's a quote from one of Clinton's advisors, and the advisor said that to you at the end of August. How do you think the president has been or will continue to redefine what his presidency is about?
Well, what struck me was how often I heard White House aides say that about Clinton. They had said it at least a year earlier when he went off for vacation with all sorts of problems. And the big saying around the White House in August of 93 was that he has to redefine his presidency. He has to come back more toward the center. He has to give a kind of overarching theme to what it is that he has been trying to do. And here, a year later, another aide is saying the same thing. And I was quite struck by that. I don't think he has had a lot of success yet at doing that. But he's going to have to, especially in the new situation he finds himself in.
Elizabeth Drew, she's the author of a new book called On the Edge, The Clinton Presidency. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new movie, The Last Seduction, is a modern film noir, a story about a ruthless woman who convinces her husband to pull off a dangerous drug deal and then steals the money from him. Coming up, we meet actress Linda Fiorentino, who plays the film's femme fatale and has been described as flawlessly hard-boiled. And we meet first-time screenwriter Steve Baranczyk. The Last Seduction was directed by John Dahl, who also directed Red Rock West. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A California judge has temporarily blocked enforcement of a provision of the new voter-approved Proposition 187. San Francisco Superior Court Judge Stuart Pollack has barred enforcement of the measure that expels illegal immigrants from public schools. He's also prohibited expulsion of undocumented workers from the state's public colleges and universities. Pollack says the new measure conflicts with a 1982 Supreme Court ruling that requires states to provide a public education to all residents. The ballot measure in California cuts off education and most health care to illegal immigrants, and it requires teachers and doctors to turn them in. President Clinton is offering an olive branch to the new GOP leadership in Congress, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The White House is still reeling from the unprecedented Republican sweep yesterday. The GOP regained control of both houses of Congress and the majority of the nation's state houses. Today, the president spoke by telephone to the new majority leader in the Senate, Bob Dole, who told him it might be possible for them to do business. White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta spoke to the man who will become the new House Speaker, Newt Gingrich. Panetta said he received a pledge to work together on GATT, the worldwide trade treaty awaiting confirmation by Congress. White House aides said they were disappointed. They didn't expect the results to be as bad as they were, but they said the GOP now had a responsibility to govern. The outgoing chairman of the Democratic Party, David Wilhelm, was more candid. "We got our butts kicked," Wilhelm said. "We were the majority party. We had our chance. The American people saw we didn't come through on certain things." At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Today is the fifth anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the event that triggered the collapse of the Warsaw Pact and the unification of Germany. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
5 years ago, an East German communist leader made the announcement that changed the course of 20th century history. Following weeks of street demonstrations, Central Committee spokesman Gunter Schabowski said travel restrictions for East Germans would be drastically eased. After several hours of uncertainty, East German border guards opened the checkpoints along the Berlin Wall. During the night, tens of thousands of Berliners crossed between East and West Berlin freely for the first time since the wall was built in 1961. Within weeks, the peaceful East German Revolution spread to other Eastern European communist countries. Less than a year later, East and West Germany were unified. The Berlin Wall and the border fortifications dividing Germany have been dismantled, although experts continue to search for undiscovered mines along the former border region. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The government says American productivity rose 2.7% between July and September. The Labor Department says this is a change in course because productivity was down in the second quarter of this year. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about a point to close at 3,831. This is NPR. One Jordanian lawmaker walked out of his country's parliament today as the upper chamber ratified the Jordanian-Israeli peace treaty. The accord is passed despite some unprecedented vocal opposition by some lawmakers who are known for their loyalty to the throne. The lawmaker who left the session says the peace treaty doesn't address Jordan's water and territorial rights, nor does it deal with the status of Palestinians and the city of Jerusalem. Passage by Jordan's upper house means a royal decree by King Hussein is all that's needed to codify the agreement. Sri Lankans went to the polls today in a crucial presidential election. Despite fears of possible violence, the voting was relatively peaceful. Eric Weiner reports from the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo.
Today's voting was marred by only a few minor incidents. The government, taking no chances, had deployed nearly 40,000 troops at polling stations and imposed a nighttime curfew. 2 weeks ago, the opposition candidate, Gamini Dissanayake, was killed along with 53 others in a suicide bomb attack. His widow has been running in his place. In fact, both major candidates have lost their husbands to Sri Lanka's endemic political violence. Chandrika Kumaratunga, the candidate from the ruling party, has been running her campaign on a peace platform, promising to end the country's 11-year civil war with the Tamil Tigers, a separatist group. Official results won't be available until sometime tomorrow, but pre-election polls suggest that Kumaratunga's peace platform is likely to sweep her into power. This is Eric Weiner in Colombo.
The United Nations wants more money to help the 2 million war victims in the Balkans. UN officials say they need $241 million to cover costs for the first 6 months of next year. Officials say the money will help displaced Bosnians, as well as Serbian and Croatian refugees. The UN says it still needs $18 million more to cover the cost for the rest of this year. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says the strife and conflict in the region is not over. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a very sexy, very wicked, very ruthless bad girl in the new film noir, The Last Seduction. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin described it as a devilishly entertaining crime story with a heroine who must be seen to be believed. In a few minutes, we'll meet the movie's star, Linda Fiorentino. The Last Seduction was directed by John Dahl, whose previous film was The Sleeper, Red Rock West. The Last Seduction was written by my guest Steve Baranczyk. It's his first screenplay. The story is about a woman named Bridget Gregory who manipulates her husband into a risky drug deal, then steals the money, skips town, and finds a new mark. But when we first meet her, she's a steely, heartless supervisor at a telemarketing company.
I can't hear you people. Maggots sound like suburbanites. $50 for a lousy coin set, you sell one at a time. Got $100 for the next sucker who makes a triple sale.
A minute, 50 seconds, Bernie. You expect these leaves to grow on trees? Want me over your shoulder all day, Bernie, huh? Ask for the sale 4 times every time. Got it?
You got 20 seconds to close it, Bernie. 15.
We are offering.
Come on your tail, Bernie. 5.
Now let's listen. $4.
$4.
A price that would be stupid to pass up. You'd have to be branded.
I understand you worked in telemarketing yourself. Did you get any inspiration for your film from your own experiences?
Got plenty of inspiration for it. I was never in an operation that bad, but I heard tell of them. I knew people who had been in them, and all it was exaggerating what I had experienced. The management is rather brutal in that environment. You're standing over your people, and exhorting would be the kind way to put it, what you're doing to them. You're just keeping them from slacking off because you need a certain amount of revenue per hour in order to justify their existence.
So what did you draw on in your experiences telemarketing in creating the character of Bridget?
I think I drew on a sales mentality. I don't think there is a moment in this movie when she isn't thinking like a salesperson, whether it's telemarketing sales or otherwise. She is always trying to sell something to another character, whether it's killing someone, whether it's doing a drug deal. She's always trying to get other people to do something for her, and that's a form of sales.
Did you learn any of the techniques she uses by being in sales yourself for a while?
Yeah, I learned some of them. I have to add that I'm an awful salesperson. My wonderful wife is a salesperson and a sales manager, and I keep my hand in sales by hearing her adventures every day. And salesmanship is something that doesn't come to everybody, and people that do know it sometimes have trouble turning it off. Or don't want to turn it off because there's so many other places in life that you can be selling, even if it's not, here's a product, give me some money. But you're selling an idea. You're selling somebody else on doing some work for you. You're selling someone else on your opinion. I think I'm just very familiar with the sales mentality.
Now, I don't want to give away any of the twists and turns in this movie, but suffice it to say that you come up with some, pretty interesting double crosses. How did you figure them out for the movie? I'm going to make the assumption that
you don't have a lot of experience with this in person.
Okay.
Was that a fair assumption?
That's a fair presumption. It's hard to think of. And without talking about the movie, I can tell you where the movie started. The movie started with the premise that someone could, or where I started writing the movie, was with the premise that you could access credit reports and find a class of people, women specifically, who were likely to want their husbands killed, which of course enters into the story. So the movie starts with telemarketing, but I actually started with telemarketing in the middle of the movie where that happens.
What was the inspiration behind sitting down and writing a movie?
Failure. Failure in short story writing, a very limited publication, two unpublished novels. I had just taught a class in screenwriting without really knowing anything about teaching screenwriting or screenwriting itself. And when I finished teaching the class, I decided it was time to give it a crack myself. So I was looking for a screen story.
The dialogue is wonderful in a new film. And, you know, particularly the Linda Fiorentino character just has, like, the perfect retort or sarcastic put down for everything that comes her way. You wrote those lines for her. Can you do that in real life?
Yeah, I can do it, but people are going to have to wait 5-6 minutes for an answer out of me. That's what appeals to me about the writing, is just being able to get the line right. And if realism's out the window because no one could be that clever all the time, I don't care. It's what I love reading. It's what I love hearing. I just love to always hear a phrase turned perfectly, or as perfectly as I can turn it. And let's face it, we don't have enough time in conversation normally to come up with the best way of saying things. That's what appeals to me about writing movies, is taking the time to find it and then giving the character those words. And the end result is, I don't think people say, oh, that's unrealistic. I think what people infer is, hey, that is one intelligent person, because I can't imagine myself coming up with a line that quickly.
Any moments in the film you're particularly proud of?
You ask about dialogue. There's one line of dialogue I love, and I don't think it stands out. But it's when Peter says to Linda, he says, murder is commitment, because she's maintaining she's committed to the relationship. She's shown commitment, but he hasn't. And Peter says, murder is commitment. And Linda says, when I've done it and you haven't, it is. Which is just, it sounds like a very simple sentence, but I can't imagine getting it out properly in conversation. And it's, I just love the sound of it.
Oh, and then she says something like, you said you wanted commitment, and commitment should mean more than just sex, shouldn't it?
Right, that's sort of the theme of the movie.
Steve Baranczyk wrote the screenplay for the new film, The Last Seduction. We'll meet the star, Linda Fiorentino, after this break. This is Fresh Air. Linda Fiorentino might generate a cult following after her performance in the new film, The Last Seduction. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin says Fiorentino plays a hot, slinky monster. Her performance is flawlessly hard-boiled, and she exults in the sheer wickedness of the character. Fiorentino made her film debut opposite Matthew Modine in Vision Quest, and also appeared in Martin Scorsese's After Hours and Alan Rudolph's The Moderns. Fiorentino describes her character of Bridget, a.k.a. Wendy, as an ambitious, immoral person in pursuit of a better life who will stop at nothing to get it. Her tool for getting it is her sexuality. I asked Fiorentino what she related to in this character.
I think she has a very keen ability to recognize the weakness in others. I think what she does that's different than what I do is abuse that power. I think I'm more compassionate than Bridget in that respect. But I do think she recognizes someone's weakness and, you know, she knows where the buttons are and she knows how to push them. And I think I have that quality, or I have had that quality at certain times in my life.
So did you model the character on partly on yourself and partly on other people you know?
I think I modeled her on some men that I've met more than anything. I mean, I've been hard put to find a woman like Bridget. You know, there are, particularly in Hollywood, there are strong, ambitious, powerful women. But it just didn't seem enough. It just seemed like I needed to take her a step further. So I started looking to men for the answer.
And what did you find from them that you incorporated into the character?
There's a key scene for me where she's been sleeping with Peter Berg, and there's a scene that follows a montage of sex scenes where he's trying to get to know her better, and she's walking through the house putting her clothes on just the way a man would zip his fly. And it, you know, for me, that was a pivotal scene, and also on a personal level, because I know almost every woman I've known and I myself have played that scene out in our real lives with men in reverse. You know, I want to get to know you better. I want more. I want to get closer to you. So for me, that was, you know, it was fun to be able to play the male part in that scene. And I think there are a lot of scenes like that in the film. And at first I wasn't sure how to play that scene, so I started asking other men, there's a slip for you. I asked men, like, what bothers them the most about women, and invariably it was, you know, they always want to get to know you better, and they're always touching you and trying to get closer, and they just don't leave you alone. And that's how Peter and I played the scene, you know, in reverse.
Why don't we hear the scene?
I'm having more and more trouble with this, Wendy.
Don't worry, you'll get the hang of it.
I mean, you're keeping me at arm's length all the time. I'm starting to feel like some kind of a...
sex object.
Yes, exactly, a sex object.
Live it up.
Why don't you just stay over?
I gotta get back.
Well, then I can come over. That's fine.
My place, my space, Mike. Don't get sticky.
What are you so scared of, huh? What are you so scared of?
I don't know. I guess it's because I've been hurt before. I don't want to get close to anyone right now. You're different than the others, Mike. I feel like, I don't know, maybe I could love you. I don't want that to happen, really. Will that do? F***ing doesn't have to be anything more than f***ing.
I'm not asking for love, all right?
Wise man.
We could talk. You could talk to me. I'd like to talk.
So talk.
Who's listening?
In your roles, you've seen how powerfully you can use sexuality in character to get men to behave the way you want them to.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing how well you can pull that off in character, do you ever try to do that as yourself?
All women do.
See, I don't think that's really true.
I do. All men do.
See, I don't think everybody thinks of themselves as having sexual power.
I don't think it's a conscious choice. I mean, I think it's more visceral than that. I think we all... I see human beings as very sexual, and it's a part of our makeup, and I think we all use that, whether we want to admit it or not, and whether we want to accept that or not. I think we all do. I don't think you can avoid it.
So do you think of yourself as being very sexy?
No, I think of other people thinking of me as being very sexy.
I see. Okay. Now, how did you decide what to wear in the movie? Was it your call, or did you work with a costume person?
No, actually, I worked with a wonderful costume designer named Terry Dresbeck, who taught me a lot about using costumes to help the character, to help create the character. And what she did, which was different than other costume designers I'd worked with, is she created a wardrobe for the character as opposed to saying, I want her to look this way. And there were days when we would just pick something out of the closet, depending on what mood I was in or the mood I thought Bridget was in, which is a very interesting way to work because you're not panicked about, you know, how you're going to look in the movie. You know, it was just the wardrobe was there, and it created the character. It helped create the character.
Now, what interested me in your wardrobe is here's this, you know, very sexy mm-hmm. woman, but she's wearing basically business suits mm-hmm. with heels and short skirts, but still they're business suits, and in a way you could say they're power clothes. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're not clothes designed to show cleavage or they're certainly not kittenish.
Well, it's also, I mean, you've already seen the movie, but if you see it again, there was a very specific choice that Terry and I made where I wear skirts up until a certain point. And once I find out Peter Berg's secret, his ultimate weakness, I start wearing pants.
Oh, I didn't
and
notice
it, it was,
that.
It's
how
a
true.
Very specific choice. So that from that point to the end of the film, I'm wearing pants.
Very interesting. Now, you smoke a lot of cigarettes in the movie.
No, isn't that terrible?
Now, all through movie history, cigarettes have been used as a dramatic prop. Mm-hmm. Do you feel you use them that way in the movie?
For me, I wanted her, you know, the two things that I wanted to give her that would show that this woman is not as much in control as one would think are the cigarettes. I mean, that's a compulsive act.
Oh, and her
and
nails.
She bites her nails.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was very strange. It wasn't even very specific. I thought about it after the fact. I was like, well, why did I choose to do that? And then I realized that's what I was doing. It was, you know, my way of saying this woman isn't that much in control, and she does have her little weaknesses, too.
Mm. Now, I think some women might see this movie and think, oh, this is a dangerous stereotype of women as being oversexed and using their sexuality as a tool to manipulate men. What would you say to somebody who saw this film as, you know, as a negative stereotype?
I would say the thing about Bridget that I like, I mean, although I do find her abominable, I mean, this is not a person I would want to be friends with, you know. The one thing I liked about her character is that she doesn't apologize for who she is. It's she's saying, the world created me this way. I grew up during a time when I was inundated with feminist literature and, you know, the world made me this way. It's not my fault that I behave this way now. And she doesn't apologize for herself. But it's not, I mean, I don't want little girls to, you know, watch this movie one day and think, oh, I want to grow up and be Bridget Gregory. I mean, I think she's the anti-hero or heroine, so to speak.
So do you see this character as being the result of feminism?
Yes. I mean, I think she personifies the backlash of feminism. It's like, you know, I don't know about you, but I grew up, you know, with my mother and every female teacher I had telling me, be independent, you know, have your own money, don't depend on a man emotionally. And I think that she, Bridget, personifies that whole idea. And it's also, you know, women started behaving like men in order to find themselves being equal to men, or they thought that was the way to be equal to men. And I think she addresses that notion. And it's also like saying, you know what, for me anyway, you don't have to behave like a man to be a strong, independent woman.
Well, I think, if anything, this character is somebody who would be the representation of the sociopath mm-hmm. interpretation of what feminism is.
Exactly. I mean, she's an exaggerated version of, you know, the grown woman of a girl who grew up during that era.
My guest is Linda Fiorentino, the star of the new film noir, The Last Seduction. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what kind of election analysis will you have for us?
Lots of news and lots of analysis, Terry. We'll be hearing about what the outlook is for a Republican-controlled Congress. We'll hear the reactions of Senator Phil Graham of Texas, Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition. Also, how the Democrats are likely to work with the new Republican majority in both houses. We'll hear about what President Clinton had to say today in his news conference, as well as more stories about the vote on Proposition 186. In California. And in addition, we'll be hearing about a klezmer group today called Brave Old World.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My My guest is Linda Fiorentino. She plays the wicked, sexy villain in the new film noir, The Last Seduction. Now, I know that you worked for a while as a bartender. What did you learn as a bartender about handling men?
The only thing I really learned as a bartender was how to steal money from people who were too drunk to leave a proper tip.
Well, how would you do that?
Just wait until they were drunk enough and, you know, just slide my hand across the bar and take a few extra dollars for myself and my partner. It's almost a tacit agreement you enter into between the patrons and the bartenders.
Now, what did you learn about talking with attitude? I mean, did you have to, like, talk tough to some people or...
Not really.
No,
I didn't do it for a very long time.
Oh, okay.
Also, my partner behind the bar was a man, so I took care of the girls for him, and he took care of the boys for me.
I see.
Teamwork.
What did he have to take care of for you, and what did you have to take care of for him?
Well, if, you know, somebody was being obnoxious, I would just send him over, you know, to take care of them. And if a girl was hitting on him too hard, I would go over and pretend I was his girlfriend. It was kind of fun. He happened to be Bruce Willis, by the way.
Are you kidding?
No.
You worked a bar together?
Yes.
When was this?
Oh, a long time ago.
Was he a good bartender?
He was a great bartender.
Now, you've said that you come from a very moral Catholic family. You went to Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
What does your family think of the roles you've been taking?
Well, I think they're proud of me and happy that I've been able to make a living at what I'm doing, particularly since they were a little disappointed when I chose to switch careers after college and study acting in New York. You know, my father had spent all this money sending me to a nice private school in Philadelphia so that I would go to law school. And then one day I said, well, Dad, I'm not going to law school. I'm going to go to acting school. So he was very disappointed, and he did try to talk me out of it. But as soon as I got my first job, you know, like, my baby, my daughter. The sexual stuff is difficult for them, but they handle it very well with me. I'm not sure how they handle it for themselves because I'm not there when they're alone. But one time, I don't know if you recall the movie The Moderns, there's this brutal scene in a bathtub with John Lone and myself. And my father went to an industry screening of the movie with, you know, a couple of members of my family and other people. And when that scene was playing, he jumped up. He was so uncomfortable. He jumped out of his chair and he just, you know, tried to distract the entire audience so they wouldn't watch me on film having sex in a bathtub with John Lone. Anybody want popcorn? You know, and he just tried to get in the way of the entire audience. It was very funny.
Were you there?
I was outside, so I didn't have to handle, you know, I didn't, you know, I heard about it. Then he came out and bought M&Ms.
Were you embarrassed?
I thought it was very funny.
Linda Fiorentino stars in the new movie, The Last Seduction. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of two celebrities and how fame changed them. We talk with actor Burt Reynolds. After a contentious series of interviews, he recently cut short his book tour. And we talk with Peter Manso about his new biography of Marlon Brando. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.